for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Hello, everybody.
Another episode great to be of back. Brew Strong. We're live here in Pacheco, California, in the studios.
A little town just west of Concord and north of the bay or south of it.
Where are I don't think anybody there? Really needs to know that.
Oh, okay.
We're here in the studios where we're broadcasting live. You can listen to us live, and you can actually join in and chat with other listeners in the chat room. Go to thebrewingnetwork.com, click on the chat now button. You don't need to enter in any password or anything. Just put in a whatever username you want, join in, and you chat with like-minded individuals.
That's right.
If you have any show topics that you want us to cover, brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. is the email address, and send that in. We don't really respond to that. That's just for show ideas, things like that.
Yeah, we read them all.
Yeah, we read them all, sometimes sober, sometimes not, but we do read them all, and our hope is that through this show, we can help you brew better beer. All right? So that's what Brewing Strong is about, is being a great brewer and knowing not just
brewing robustness.
Yeah, not just following along, but you know, like McChad here, here in the studio. He's an excellent brewer, and you know, I think one of the reasons he is because he has a curiosity about you know, what parts of the process, what it's doing. Right? It's not just like, what do I do? Tell me what to do, and I'll just do it. It's like, well, you know, all right, now why would I do that? What am I trying to achieve? What sort of result is that going to have? How does that make my beer better?
Yeah.
And by understanding all that, I think he's brewing strong. I think he's becoming a better brewer,
right,
and making a better beer, and that's brewing strong. Not brewing high gravity beers, not high alcohol beers, but being brewing smart, brewing from knowledge, from skill, from you know, from all that. That's brewing strong.
That's right. That's what we're here on. That's what we're all about. Brewing classic styles. That's what we promote.
Fine book.
It is.
Well, probably one of the best books ever written about home brewing and brewing and brewing recipes. Probably the best collection of recipes ever collected in the world.
Probably the best.
Who wrote that? No. Okay. Yeah, we have those available in the Brewing Network store. Actually, you can get that various places. You can get that from, you know, something like, you know, these mass market retailers around the web. And you can get it from the AHA website. Good people there.
Yep.
You can get it from them. But one of the places you can get it signed by both authors, John Palmer and myself, is in the Brewing Network store. Go to thebrewingnetwork.com, go to the store, you can pick up signed copies of Brewing Classic Styles. You can get signed copies of John's book, How to Brew, the seminal work on really everything from starting out to becoming a real expert. So any level of brewer you are, I guarantee you, or I will buy the book from you, you will find something in that book you did not know. You will find some information in that book that you did not know that can help you make better beer. How to brew.
I hope that is the
case.
And
so we got signed copies of that in the store. And there's also a very fine Brew Strong shirts.
Yes, these are sweet shirts.
In red and in gray. They got the mash paddle on it. Excellent artwork on that. I'm really pleased with how that turned out. Justin put a lot of effort into making sure that those turned out well.
Yeah, there's and, a little BN Army logo on the back of it.
I know, I really like that.
In the front,
actually,
with the mash pedal.
I like that. It's absolutely my favorite. You know, the hop grenade shirts. I really love those too. They have those available also in the store. You probably want to get yourself multiples and only wear BN Army
gear. That's right. Have one for every day of the week.
I generally do. When I always make sure I wear this. I'm wearing those shirts out. Ah, yes. And as a matter of fact, I was wearing one, took the family down, got in the RV, chug in my RV down to Southern California, down to your area there. We spent a few days over the holidays at Disneyland, like we're wont to do every year.
Mm-hmm.
And
you wore your Bruce Strong shirt at Disneyland?
I did. Was I wearing the Bruce Strong or was I wearing the Hop Grenade? I think I wore the Hop Grenade at Disneyland. Yeah, it's a little more, how do you say?
Family oriented or?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I did wear my Bruce Strong shirt. I got an opportunity. We visited my sister in Del Mar and parked the RV out in front of her multi-million-dollar home. I tell you, the RV I can afford is a 12-year-old RV, right? It's not fancy, right? So it's kind of like National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, where they park yes. the RV on the lawn, and the family's in there hooking up all the cords and stopping up all the toilets. That's me.
You're the brother-in-law.
I'm the hillbilly family that comes to visit. All the neighbors. This is like a on a slope viewing the ocean. The tiniest little house goes for a couple of million. And I've got my my 10-cent RV parked out in front and living out of that thing. But it was great. And one of the great things was I got a chance to visit my brothers and sisters in Coif. I went down to Harold Gabranson's house, and he's got the most amazing setup there. I took the wife with me, and we went, and she got to see. He's got this amazing brew shed that his wife Joanne kind of got contracted and built, and it's brew shed is it's like a brew home. It's got it's just stunning from the the counters to the sinks and the storage for his brewing equipment and the tile floors and the toilets and the walk-in fridge, dishwasher, the cabinets for the glassware. Oh, wow. I mean, it's just stunning. It's like if you were to, have a big meal and have a wet dream about, your perfect brewing environment, this would be it. Because it's a brewing environment plus a party environment. And, their whole place is wonderful. And they're just the greatest people in the world. But what was really cool was I got to see a lot of my friends that I haven't seen for quite a while. I used to be down in San Diego quite a bit, but lately it's been a while.
A lot of good folks down there.
And one guy I met, that I hadn't met before was this guy Cole, and I guess he helped out with the World Beer Cup. And what's cool about people knowing a lot about beer is when they see an unusual beer, one that they haven't seen before. Now, a lot of people, they'll help out with, GABF or competitions or, whatever event, and they'll grab what they know. Yeah. But you get a real good beer geek like this guy, Cole, and, he grabs things that he's never seen before, the things that you can't buy locally, right? And I don't know if you've ever seen this Vin de Cereal.
I have not seen that one before.
I had never seen it before. And, so here's this array. I personally didn't bring anything down. I didn't know that I'd make it to the party. So I went to BevMo.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
California institution.
Right. Went to BevMo and I bought, like $50 worth of, some pretty high-end stuff. All stuff that I knew. Mm-hmm. I think there's maybe one that I hadn't tried before. But so all this, everybody was showing up for the party. They had all this stuff stacked out on this table. And it's just an amazing array of great beers, it's $15 a bottle type of stuff, right?
Yeah, all over the world.
And I've seen all of them. I've tried all of them. There's like one or two I hadn't tried, and they were all right. They were kind of interesting. But this one from Rodenbach, which, of course, is absolutely one of my favorites. And Vin de Cereal, I had never seen before. That one caught my eye. I'm thinking, I got to have a taste of that. Turns out this guy, Cole, he had brought it, and he was like, hey, you want to taste this? I'm like, yes. That is the only one that really caught my interest of all the beers here. And it's like a 10% alcohol.
I was wondering if Vin de Cereal translated as barley wine or...
Yeah, or, you know, wine, you know.
Wine of the cereal.
Yeah, barley wine. 10% by volume. And this is aged in, you know, they even have the VAT number, like, you know, number 132. And they make, and I've read a little bit more about this on the website, they make, like, 10,000 bottles or something of this, and like half, or maybe 20,000 bottles, half goes to local, and then half gets shipped out.
Okay.
So a very limited run on this thing, and each bottle is numbered, and for 3 years, I think. I sent it off to a friend of mine to see if he could translate the label for me. I haven't heard back from him yet. Told Cole that I will. That's why I have the label. And it was fantastic. I mean, just stunning. Everybody who tried it was like, wow. You know, these folks really know what they're doing.
So it was a sour beer, was it, with kind of like a Flanders red? Or?
Yeah, not quite as sour as, you know, like a Rodenbach Grand Cru. Probably more along the lines of regular Rodenbach, but it had a real malty character. It was all like pale malt.
Oh, okay. Not one of the sour browns.
Not nearly that color. It was all very pale, and 10% alcohol for a sour beer is actually very tricky to do. You get past 8% alcohol, not much will live in an 8% alcohol beer. This is one of the keys to making like an Eau de Brun or something like that, is that 8% cutoff where the lactobacillus stops working, things like that,
right,
where it's just not going to sour very much. So how you get 10% plus, you know, the sourness and all that in one batch is tricky.
Yeah.
So I thought that
sounds like great beer. I wish I could have had some.
Well, sorry. Drank it all.
Good on you, mate.
There you go. From our trip to Australia. You know. And one of the things I found interesting about it is like zero carbonation. Wasn't carbonated at all. I mean, there was maybe like a touch over atmospheric, but it was pretty much uncarbonated.
Wow.
As far as we go.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, we all kind of commented, but we liked it. It was appropriate for that beer. So that's the interesting thing, you know, carbonation appropriate for that beer.
Yeah.
And that brings up today's topic, which is carbonation, where, you know, a lot of people struggle with carbonation. It seems on its surface a very simple thing.
Right.
Carbonating your beer. It's like, okay, but, you know, How exactly do you determine, you know, what's appropriate carbonation? How do you make that carbonation happen? You know, what's the problem if you don't make that happen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. Yeah, I waffle between having, you know, no regard for exactly how much carbonation I have, and but I, on the other hand, I know that there are levels of carbonation that make a beer
right.
pop.
No regard whatsoever. So, you know, any care carbonated or not, then that would be no regard.
Well, okay. Some regard.
Some regard. All right. Yeah. So, and what we got, I got a question emailed in from Alan. He said, Dear Pope Malty, I really love the shows and especially Brewing Classic Styles. Again, you can find that in the Brewing Network store. I've had great success with the recipes from the book, but have trouble with something that seems so simple, carbonation. In the book, you give specific numbers for how many volumes of CO2 for each recipe and style. This is great. However, I naturally carbonate and seem to have a hard time hitting those numbers. A few things came to mind. Is it, one, because I'm reading the carbonation chart wrong in the book? Two, because my beer isn't fermented right? Three, I don't want to switch to kegging because people tell me CO2 from natural carbonation tastes better. Four, how do I know I have the right amount of carbonation, Alan? All right, so that's what today's show's about. It's going to be carbonation. And what we'll do, we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll get into all the aspects of carbonation, what it is, how to do it.
How to control it.
How to ensure your brewing strong.
That's right.
Back after this.
Right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of 13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of 25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The More Beer deal of the day.
Announcing the Beer, Beer, and More Beer deal of the day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess.
The More Beer deal of the day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something. Find the More Beer deal of the day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
Hi, I'm Sean O'Sullivan, the brewmaster and co-founder of the 21st Amendment Brewery and Restaurant in San Francisco. 6 years ago, Nico Freccia and I opened the 21st Amendment on 2nd Street with the intent of bringing back the local neighborhood brew pub. Well, the neighborhood has really changed over the years, but the 21st Amendment still remains a great place for people to meet over a terrific meal and a tasty pint of beer. In the past, the only way you could enjoy the 21st Amendment's handcrafted beers was at the brew pub. Well, all that has changed. Now, the 21st Amendment beers are available in cans. That's right, cans. When was the last time you had a great beer in a can? Well, that day has come. We're offering our world-famous Watermelon Wheat and 21A IPA in cans. Cans are a better package than glass because cans keep the beer fresher longer, but you can also take cans to places where bottles can't go, like the beach, lake, golf courses, and sporting events. So join us in the revolution to take back the can from the big breweries and crack open a cold 21A craft beer in a can. The 21st Amendment, 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park.
Okay, I rolled a 15 and I get a +2 from my yeast starter.
Nope, sorry, you failed your roll. Your beer is infected.
No way!
You had to beat a 24. It's schizosaccharomyces.
This sucks! I just failed versus oxidation! Our party is fracked! Doug's the only one left and his beer is a Berliner Weiss!
What's this? A tea party?
Hey, this is a brew session, man. Get lost!
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah, I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Does your significant other know the difference between an Irish red ale and a Flanders red ale? Do you burp, drizzle, spalt, and fart Y-East 2308? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Northern Brewer has all your beer nerd needs, ingredients, equipment, and knowledge 24 hours a day at northernbrewer.com. Plus, fast, cheap shipping, only $7.99 for the contiguous USA. And check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the socially awkward Patter's Beer and the sci-fi convention showstopper number 8. Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
This is www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
Pardon me.
Hey, howdy, hey.
It always degenerates. Starting with the second show, and then it just gets worse and worse. We're talking carbonation today. I'm here with my good buddy here, John Palmer.
How do you, everybody?
Author of How to Brew. And also in the studio, we got Sleepy McChad. He's falling asleep there.
Jamaica.
And Justin working the boards here. And we're talking carbonation.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So John, give us a definition. What is carbonation?
Well, carbonation, as we talk about it in the book especially, is, you know, it's how much carbon dioxide is dissolved into the beer.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about a volume of CO2, we're, the definition of one volume of CO2 is essentially 1 liter of CO2 dissolved into 1 liter of solution, or in this case, beer.
Okay, you're jumping ahead. You're looking at my notes. You're jumping ahead. All right, so yeah. See, the problem is I make notes for this show. You know, when I was doing the Jamil show, there was no notes.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
Very freewheeling. Very
commando style.
Yeah.
No. So carbonation is the CO2 dissolved in the beer, and what does that carbonation do? It helps lift aromatics out of the beer. It helps form the head.
Right.
It's critical to forming a head on the beer.
Mouthfeel.
A variety of aspects of the beer are controlled by carbonation. So it's actually quite important. And it may seem simplistic to say, well, what's carbonation? Most people kind of understand, but it's the amount of CO2 dissolved in the beer.
Yeah.
And different beer styles require different levels of CO2, right?
Right. You know, not necessarily they taste better at particular levels of carbonation.
Excellent.
Because you get
point.
Better expression of flavors.
Right. So in brewing classic styles, for every recipe in there, we talk about the volumes of CO2 that are required as far as carbonation for that beer or that style. Now, a volume of CO2, you were saying, was
one liter of CO2 mm-hmm. dissolved into 1 liter of beer.
So an equivalent volume of CO2, whatever volume of beer, you have a gallon of beer.
A gallon of CO2.
If you have a gallon of CO2, that's one volume.
Right.
Most beers that we're used to here in the U.S. are carbonated 2.5 to maybe 3 volumes.
Right, which would be like 2.5 gallons
of CO2 to...
And we're talking
gaseous CO2. If you were to take that CO2 out of the beer, you would have, and you filled up a plastic bag, you'd have mm-hmm. 2.5 gallons of volume of CO2 in that bag, and that gets dissolved into the beer, and that's the appropriate carbonation for, let's say, your average American ale.
Right. Right.
Okay. So that's a volume of CO2. Well, and I think, if we go back to Alan's questions, mm-hmm. Alan had some excellent questions, and we hear these all the time.
We do.
All right. Let's back a little bit. How do you get carbonation in the beer? There's a couple of methods, right? There's carbonation from the yeast. Yeast will produce carbon dioxide as they process the sugars and create
During fermentation, the yeast are creating carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. and you're going to end up with a certain equilibrium concentration of carbon dioxide in the beer. As mm-hmm. it's sitting there in the carboy or fermenter with the airlock on, there is going to be a certain dissolved equilibrium volume of CO2 in that beer.
And that's going to change, though, based on, let's say you have some sort of back pressure on the airlock or whatever, or you have just a piece of loose foil that could change mm-hmm. it slightly. Right?
But yeah, I mean, it's going to depend on local conditions of mm-hmm. temperature and pressure.
Uh-huh.
So if you're in Pacheco,
vibration,
yeah, or if you're in Colorado, mm-hmm. up to a couple thousand feet,
there you go. Atmospheric pressure will play a big role then.
That's right, and when it comes to talking about charts and equations that you see in books, typically they're talking about sea level pressure. They're not talking about elevated pressure, atmospheric pressure.
Now wait, for the chart in Brewing Classic Styles on
page, very nice girl, page 299.
All right, so there's a couple of charts in there that'll actually help you determine how much priming sugar and temperature and pressure if you're kegging,
right,
to determine to get the right level of CO2. Now, do you have an adjustment for that for altitude?
I don't.
You'll have that done and post it on the website.
We will post that to MrMulty.com, I suspect.
Okay.
We'll make up a little tiny little program like the pitching calculator.
Yeah, I said I would do that. How many years ago?
Soon, yeah.
Soon. Okay. Well, so touche. You threw that right back at me and caught me off guard with that one. All right. So Alan's first question was, am I reading the chart wrong in the book?
Probably not.
Well. All right, so
it's just you, Alan.
All right, so I've fermented my beer, and I'm going just primary. I'm not, you know, I've got an average ale. It's at 67 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
And I've got 5 gallons of it. It's sitting on my counter. It's at room temperature. It's 67 degrees.
Right.
It's fermented out. I see no more activity in the airlock, and I've given it a couple extra days, so I see nothing happening. Now, I want to carbonate this. How do I go about that? The Brewing Classic Styles for that recipe tells me I need 2.5 volumes. Right. How do I get 2.5 volumes in that beer?
Okay. Well, what we've done in the
book. How do we read the chart?
Yeah, how do we read the chart? What we've done in Brewing Classic Styles, and it kind of builds off Dave Draper's work that he had posted to the internet several years ago. Basically, you say, okay, how much carbon dioxide do I have in the beer?
Because you know, it reaches an equilibrium.
Right.
Just naturally, any liquid has CO2 dissolved in it. There's CO2 in the air that we breathe. There's nitrogen, there's oxygen, all that stuff. You naturally get a certain amount dissolved into
right.
your beer, plus the fermentation, things like
right.
that.
Right. And so if you fermented the beer in a closed container with an airlock on it, what you've done is you've said that you're not going to allow very much diffusion of atmospheric carbon dioxide or nitrogen or and oxygen into the fermenter. What the pressure's got to equalize. You got to have the same pressure inside the vessel as outside the vessel. Inside the fermenter, all that pressure is going to be supplied by CO2 that the yeast has generated during fermentation. So depending on the temperature and the atmospheric pressure, and we assume the atmospheric pressure is at 1 atmosphere or near sea level,
mm-hmm.
and that is a good number for most everybody in the U.S. and around the world, where you're generally living at say 0 to 1,000 feet, of elevation. I mean, you're ballpark, you're near 1 atmosphere of pressure. So then you turn to temperature. What is the temperature that beer is sitting at? Because that affects how much CO2 can dissolve into that beer. The higher the temperature, the less carbon dioxide can dissolve into the beer. And so what we do with both the priming sugar nomograph, which can be found in both How to Brew and Brewing Classic Styles, and then the other chart, which is basically for you people that keg your beer, how much overpressure do you need to supply to the keg at a temperature to get a particular volume of CO2. And as we said, 1 volume of CO2 is equivalent to 1 volume or 1 liter of carbon dioxide dissolved into 1 liter of beer, or 1 gallon to 1 gallon. If a beer calls for 2.5 volumes of carbon dioxide, that's equivalent to 2.5 gallons of CO2 dissolved into 1 gallon of beer. And you start out with how much carbon dioxide is in the beer at equilibrium at a certain temperature, and then how much extra carbonation do you need to put into that beer, either through priming sugar or through overpressure of a CO2 tank on the keg to get 2.5 volumes, if that's the target you're looking for.
Can you give us a quick rundown on how to use those charts? Just real brief.
Sure.
On, what you might do.
Yeah.
People following along.
Yeah, if you turn to page 298, and I do apologize if you don't have a copy of Brewing Classic Styles.
If you don't have a copy of Brewing Classic Styles, screw you! Bastard!
Yes. No, not really.
Break the wallet open. Get the $20 out. Oh.
But the priming sugar nomograph is available online at howtobrew.com. And, don't try to turn to it now. You can look it up later. But what you do is you draw a line from the temperature of the beer in the fermenter, what temperature is that beer sitting at? Is it 65, or is it 40? Is it in the fridge? What is the ambient temperature of the beer in the fermenter?
Because it's going to have naturally some CO2 dissolved in it already.
Right.
You need to take that into account, otherwise you're going to overcarbonate.
That's right. And you draw a line from that scale over through the desired volumes of CO2.
So instead of drawing a line. Here, I'm interpreting for my mechanically oriented John Palmer. Take a note card, 3x5 note card, or a sheet of paper, and use that as your straight edge,
right,
to go across to the numbers.
Yeah. So let's say we have a beer that's at 60 degrees, and we want 2.5 volumes of CO2 in the final beer. We draw a line from 60 across a straight edge, 2.5. Oh yeah. And we come out with, it looks like 3.8. Yeah, about 3.8 ounces of cane sugar, or 3.6 ounces of cane sugar versus 3.8 ounces of corn sugar or dextrose to achieve 2.5 volumes of CO2. And that difference is the fact that sucrose, table sugar, white sugar, cane sugar, provides a little bit more carbonation per weight, per unit weight, than dextrose or corn sugar does. And that what you're doing in this nomograph is you're taking the amount of CO2 that exists in the beer at 60 degrees and adding enough additional fermentables to come out with an end pressure of 2.5 volumes of CO2. And that's assuming, you know, that the priming sugar is fermented well in the beer.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get 2.5 volumes out of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that brings up a couple of interesting things, is fermentation and, if a beer, one thing, if you have a lot of leftover fermentable sugars, let's say you have a very poor fermentation.
Right, or you're brewing a high-gravity beer like a barley wine.
Right.
It's slow to ferment.
And you let's say you pitch some extra yeast, and you give it some time. If you have a lot of unfermented sugars that are readily fermentable by the yeast, simpler sugars, that can affect your carbonation over time as well.
That's right. Yeah, one thing when you're trying to establish a level of carbonation in the beer by adding, especially by natural carbonation or even overpressure, you want to start with a beer that has finished its fermentation. You don't want a beer that's only 80% or 90% done fermenting, because you're trying to say, I've got X amount of carbon dioxide in equilibrium in this beer, and I'm going to add more, a certain quantity more to get my final number. If that beer's not done fermenting, then your equation's going to be off. You're getting X plus Y plus Z. Mm-hmm. Of unfermentables that haven't happened yet. So you want to have a beer that is completely fermented out.
So it's important to make sure, good fermentation practices, fully fermented, give it time to finish up before
That's right.
you try and carbonate.
That's right. And then you add a certain amount of priming sugar or a certain amount of overpressure in the keg to force carbonate, mm-hmm. to get your final carbonation volume.
Well, another question I get a lot of times is people either they say, well, I filter my beer and it's taking out all the yeast, or, I've let my beer sit for so long, lagering, and it's sitting there in the fridge. I'm afraid there's no yeast in there. What do I do if I've done that or I've filtered? And what you can do is, they want to know about adding back yeast. And they want to specifically know how much yeast to add back. What a commercial brewery like Sierra Nevada does is to repitch. They'll filter out all their yeast. They'll repitch with about 1 billion cells per liter of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So in your average 5-gallon batch, it's close to 20 liters. It's about 19 liters. You would use about 19 billion cells. In a gram of dry yeast, you got about 20 billion cells, a fifth of a White Labs vial, or a fifth of a XL Smack Pack, or one of those propagator packs is about 35. It's a little bit much. And one of the things is, you don't want to over yeast your beer. You don't want to add too much yeast because the excessive amount of yeast will end up italicizing in the beer, causing a lot of off flavors over time. You know, if you're going to be drinking this beer within a few months, it's not a big deal. But if this is something you want to age for years, you really want to be very careful about how much yeast is in that beer. It's better to be on the short side than on the heavy side. So you can add that yeast back. Again, you know, a gram of properly rehydrated dry yeast is just about right for 5 gallons of beer.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind that most dry yeast packages have like 7 or 15 grams per package.
Right, or, you know, 5 to 11.
Yeah.
They have...
various numbers.
Yeah. So you want to be careful of that. Now, this brings up a interesting question here, and I think Alan also brought this up. I don't want to switch to kegging. People tell me that CO2 from natural carbonation tastes better. Okay. Now, this is one thing I've adamantly gone over is, you know, CO2 is CO2. All right, when we're talking CO2, carbon, oxygen, you know, two oxygens and a carbon, right? That is...
it's a compound. It doesn't separate.
It's exactly CO2. It doesn't matter where it comes from. It comes out of your ass. It's still CO2.
That's right.
Doesn't really come out of your ass. It's more methane. But,
right. You know. But if it's welding gas CO2, right, or if it's natural fermentation CO2,
it's
CO2.
Right. Now... The thing that is possibly different between forced carbonation in a keg and bottle conditioning is you probably end up with more yeast if you bottle condition, which can be a bad thing, actually.
Yeah. Consolidation.
And you'll also, you could, in theory, you know, reconditioning in the bottle could help reduce some of the... maybe diacetyl, acetaldehyde.
Right.
Some of that could possibly be reduced if you're not fermenting properly to start with. Maybe it helps draw down some of those residual sugars that should have been fermented out. Right. Things like that. So that could possibly help.
If you got any oxygen into the bottle at packaging,
right.
That you could
help.
Clean up some of that.
But if you're not filtering your beer. And you're not waiting an excessively long time. There's still lots of yeast in your beer. It looks brilliantly clear, but trust me, there is tons of yeast still floating around in there. And when you put that in bottles, if you wait a couple of years, you'll see a nice layer across the bottom. There's plenty of yeast there to pick up a lot of O2, things like that. So... I'm not convinced that the benefits of bottle conditioning outweigh the drawbacks of bottle conditioning, which is excessive amounts of yeast, because you're going to add some sugar, you're going to grow a little bit more yeast, you're going to end up, you know, along those lines, right?
Yeah. Bottle conditioning is different than forced carbonation, no question. Is it better? No. Is it worse? No. It is different. So it's going to depend, you know, there's a lot of factors that are going to weigh into that of, you know, how does this particular beer benefit or not benefit from natural carbonation versus forced carbonation?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's going to depend on your process, you know, and that particular fermentation that you are re-fermenting in the bottle, whether it's going to improve it or it's going to, you know, stay the same or it's going to be a detriment. I think going back to Alan's question, is natural carbonation better than forced carbonation? No. I don't think there's any basis to say that it's better or tastes better. I think, you know, given a particular style of beer and your brewing prowess and process, it could be different, and it could be an improvement or it may not be an improvement. But, you know, in terms of generalization, you can't say. I force carbonate all my beers, and I don't see any detriment to doing that. You know, versus naturally carbonate them.
Yeah, for me as well. I think you know, minimizing the amount of residual yeast in the bottle is actually a better thing. I think if you had perfect packaging practice. and you had perfect fermentation. And, you know, you could package without any stress on the beer, no oxygen being introduced, and no staling factors introduced. Then I would say you'd be better off without any yeast whatsoever.
Right.
If you could perfectly package it, let's say. Just in a, you know, in a, you know, ideal world. There's no oxygen introduced. You have a perfect oxygen-tight barrier.
Right.
Everything's been perfect all the way to that point. Not having yeast in there would be even better for the beer.
Yeah, in a perfect world.
Yeah, but yeah. Right. And in an imperfect world, the residual yeast that you normally have, unless you're filtering,
right.
You've got plenty of yeast in there to resolve any of those issues. So adding more yeast and more sugar and things like that, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, bottle carbonation, I think.
Right.
But
yeah.
I'm not convinced that it actually helps long-term stability. I think if you're looking at, you know, short-term, it might be better.
Mm-hmm.
Long-term, I think it's worse.
Yeah. It comes down to it's different. So, you know, your process, your beer, it's going to, you know, bottle conditioning is going to be slightly different than forced carbonation. If you go through the time and trouble to determine whether one is better than the other, then, you know, more power to you and stick with it. But there's nothing to detract from forced carbonation in my mind.
I'm trying to
open
this
tasty beer
bottle of Ballast Point Sea Monster that Justin just brought out, which
from the deep dark depths of something.
You ever have that one, JD?
San Diego. No, I haven't.
Picked it up either. Fresh from the brewery in San Diego there. And
what were you doing down there?
You had said you liked it. I was just hanging out with the Whites for a couple days, getting out of Dodge.
See, you know, you live the life of the beer cognoscenti, the people in touch. Me, I'm just like frickin' boob on the
Nebraska.
Out of Nebraska. No, I'm like nothing.
But you get my sloppy seconds. I mean, I bring back you a 22. So,
That's true.
You had mentioned before the show you really like Ballast Point.
I do.
I forgot that
Ballast
I had
Point's
that.
Great.
And that's one of their limited release ones. So sorry to interrupt the show with it, but I thought you'd like it.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm just feeling, you know, so left out, you know.
you have all this celebrity status and none of the celebrity benefits.
That's right. You know, people thinking I'm like a mover and a shaker. I tell you, you know, I'm shaking it, but that's about it. Yeah, I've got to depend on my own hand to be doing the shaking.
Yeah, I'm hanging out in White's penthouse above Petco Park down there, just chilling.
See, Chris won't return my calls. You know, I'm telling you, I'm nobody. Yeah. I'm nobody around here. Jesus Christ!
Yeah.
Well,
you got to learn to hobnob a little better.
You know, the knob has never been for me.
Justin's just known as being that sought-after party guy.
The fact is, I'm an ass, and Justin's a nice guy. And that's what it boils down to. That's, you know, behind
you gotta be
the,
nice to people.
Behind the scenes, that's what determines it. You know, I'm a dick. Everybody who meets me knows that, and they avoid me.
Yeah.
Who do you want to argue this?
Yes. Yeah,
nobody. Nobody's
is anyone going to stand up?
Nobody's going to come to my defense. That's it. That's it. Justin might, but that's just because, you know, that's just
because I need you to keep working.
That's right.
Okay.
That's it.
Let me go back to the book for just a second.
Back to the book.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Your book. Yes. In Appendix D on page 299, we have a chart that is basically keg overpressure to achieve a certain volume of CO2. Hey, it works better if I talk in the mic. A certain overpressure of CO2 on a keg to achieve a certain volume of CO2 at a temperature. So let me pull out an example here. If your beer is sitting at 50 degrees F or 10 degrees C, it's going to have a certain equilibrium pressure of CO2 in it. Let's say you want 2.0 volumes of CO2 in this beer when you serve it for this style. By using this chart, you go down the left-hand side to 50 degrees F, 10 degrees C, and you look across there for the appropriate amount of CO2 you want. So let's say you want 2.0. Well, 1.9 is close. 2.3 is the next number. That corresponds to 10 PSI of overpressure on the keg. That's what you would set your regulator to. And or in, if you're in Australia, that would be 69 kPa, 70 kPa, to get two volumes approximately.
Sound like
two
kilopascals or something?
Yeah, kilopascals.
There you go.
Yeah.
I remember something.
Yeah. Pascal was a buddy of mine. Yeah. And then I don't remember his first name.
Bob.
Yeah, there you go.
Bob Pascal.
But at 50 degrees, or you will have 2.0 or 1.9 here if you look at the chart on page 99. 1.9, to get 1.9 volumes of CO2, you need to put 10 psi or 69 kilopascals on overpressure on that keg to get that number. That's how you read it. You go down the left side to pick your temperature. Look across the chart to the right to select how many volumes of CO2 you want, and then look up towards the top line to read out how much overpressure you want on the keg. That's it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Even Jamil didn't know how to use it.
Yeah, I just randomly adjust my pressure regulator.
Yeah,
all right, that brings up another question that Alan had was, how do I know I have the right amount of carbonation? Now, on the drive out here, I know you and I were talking, we came up with some theories on how you could actually measure. Now, there's a Zomnagel CO2 tester. You can spend thousands of dollars and run these tests to actually determine. This is how carbonation is determined in packaged beer.
Right.
They check, it pierces the top of the bottle cap, and then there's a chemical reaction. You measure the amount, and you say, okay, there's X volumes of CO2. Now, how can you do that on the cheap? And so I was thinking, hey, you take a plastic grocery bag, those real flimsy plastic grocery bags. You don't want to put any back pressure on the beer, so you don't want like a balloon would cause pressure.
Right.
So resistive pressure that would force CO2 into solution. So you take one of these plastic grocery bags, put it on, open your bottle of beer, you put that on there with some rubber bands to hold it tight, and then you let that thing sit for a day or two and see how much CO2 comes out and fills the bag. You measure that amount of CO2, mm-hmm. and that's going to tell you how many volumes of CO2 you had in that beer.
Right. The key is that you don't know what the equilibrium concentration is at your ambient temperature mm-hmm. for that beer. So,
is it not always one volume?
I don't think so. It may be like 0.7 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to depend on the temperature, and you'd have to look up in the CRC manual or one of those reference books is
how much CO2 dissolves in a given liquid at a given temperature and atmospheric pressure.
Right.
That's going to be how much CO2 is in the beer after this exercise, right?
That's right.
And that may or not be 1 liter or, one volume of CO2. Let's say you have a 12-ounce beer. 12 ounces of beer, you may not have 12 ounces of CO2
dissolved at equilibrium.
Yeah.
So you're going to have some volume that's going to be in the beer, and you're going to have some volume that has now escaped from the beer and partially inflated that bag.
Uh-huh.
And to measure how much is in that bag, we talked about, you could
submerge the bag in water.
Submerge the bag in water.
You know, a known diameter if you're using a bucket or a known
graduated cylinder
or something like that, a flask. And you submerge that bag, just the bag, not your hand or whatever,
right.
and see how much the water goes up. You measure how much difference that is from the top to when you started. You multiply that times the surface area of the cylinder or square or whatever you're using, and
but
that
volume change,
volume.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you'd have, if you know what's dissolved in equilibrium wise, and that mm-hmm. may be, so many milliliters, and measure the milliliters mm-hmm. of CO2 that's mm-hmm. filling the bag. Mm-hmm. Then you have the total volumes of CO2 in that beer.
Mm-hmm. So, when I first thought of this, I thought, well, you get that bag to fill up, and then you just kind of tighten down until you got that bag sitting there, and hold it up next to the bottle. And I thought, well, you could kind of estimate. You know, is that like, you know, 2 times the size of the bottle, 3 times the size of the bottle, 4 times the size of the bottle, 1 time the size of the bottle?
That's right.
And that should kind of give you a kind of a ballpark as to, you know, a real cheap and easy way to say, oh, I've got so many volumes of CO2 in that beer.
That's a good way to do it. The only point you really don't know is what the equilibrium concentration is.
Right.
And if I had had a few more minutes and a couple brain cells before the show, I would have looked that up.
But, well, you'll find this on MrMalty.com at some point.
That's right.
Along with the other calculators that are yet to be done. Well, and, you know, so we assume that that concentration is probably less than one volume of CO2, maybe a half volume or something like that is
right.
What I would guess.
If you kind of, if you look at the chart and kind of extrapolate from that.
Because we're talking CO2 in the environment, right? Or
yeah. If you look at an overpressure of 5 psi on page 299, and you look at 85 degrees Fahrenheit or 29 C, 5 psi is needed to create one volume of CO2. So, in other words, the equilibrium concentration at 85 degrees less than 1 volume.
How much CO2 is in the air that we breathe?
I don't know. 15%? I know it's 70% nitrogen.
Mm-hmm. Almost 20% oxygen.
Yeah, so I guess that would make me 10%. 8%.
9%, something like that. And then
we're
at 15 PSI, so 9% of 15 PSI. 14.7 PSI, actually.
Okay. Go ahead and work that out, Chad.
Okay, so it's like, you know, it's about 1.4 PSI of CO2. So not a lot of CO2 at equilibrium, right? But, I think... it's an interesting exercise, not really critical.
And so during this break, everybody go out and work this out on paper and get back to us.
What we're going to do is we're going to come back. We're going to talk about really what effect the carbonation has on beer.
We'll be back
after this.
Okay.
Strong. We'll be right back.
What's good for the earth, good for your body, and great for your brew? Organic ingredients. This holiday season, the Organic Ingredient Experts Seven Bridges Co-op in awesome Santa Cruz, California, offers you the gift that keeps on giving to our planet. Sustainable, fair-wage ingredients to make the best organic homebrew you've ever had. There's a growing demand for organic products, and your choice to brew with them supports organic farmers worldwide. Brew organic, and you'll brew excellent beer that is free from chemical residues and genetically modified organisms, and you'll help contribute to a better world. If you're looking for organic ingredients, Seven Bridges offers a huge selection of USDA-certified kits and raw ingredients from 8 ounces to 50-pound sacks of grain, whole and pellet hops, and all the equipment you need. Seven Bridges, the organic homebrew expert since 1997. Visit www.breworganic.com.
Attention homebrew shop owners at Fermentap. They know you're tired of buying the same old gear that everyone else has. That's why Fermentap offers the newest and most cutting-edge brewing equipment known to man. Since 1998, Fermentap has been leading the fight against the boring and mundane by offering strange, unique, and just plain smart equipment. Like their stainless-domed false bottoms. Never deal with the floating plastic hassle of other false bottoms again. And since they're made from stainless steel, they'll last a lifetime. Fermentap's line of copper wort chillers are the best on the market, designed to cool your wort faster and more efficiently than other immersion chillers. They actually invented the equipment to make these chillers not only work great, but look great too. How about a fantastic line of ingredients, including vanilla beans, sorghum extract, blue agave extract, hop bitterness extract, unique wine yeasts, green coffee beans, sake kits, all stuff you can't find anywhere else. Fermentap carries all the standard products and equipment you need as well, such as all grain systems, stainless hardware, kettles, carbonation stones, you name it, they've got it. Fermentap's entire line of products has been helping retail shops meet the demands of their customers for nearly 10 years, and they want to help you too. For more information, see them on the web at fermentap.com or call Jason at 1-800-942-2750. Fermentap, better beer through innovation.
Did you know that every day a brewcaster goes to bed hungry? Did you know that that brewcaster is silently calling for the help of people just like you? Do you know that every day the unicorn and the rainbow have to blow sailors for loose change? For less than the cost of a half-calf, quad-shot, venti, extra-hot, soy milk, triple-pump, hazel, low-fat foam, double-cupped macchiato a day, you can help starving adults in Pacheco. Your love can be felt for as little as 7 cents a day. Visit thebrewingnetwork.com/donate to sign up today for as little as $2 a month. Private first class in the BN Army. Buy your way up the ranks as corporal, sergeant, ranger, or colonel with an easy-to-do monthly donation that keeps brewcasters alive and your favorite internet radio station broadcasting. No donation is too small to help those in need. Can't you find it in your heart to share your love with a brewcaster? In return, you will enjoy the wealth of knowledge that comes with every episode of The Session, The Jameel Show, and yes, even that other show. Thank you for listening, and please sign up for your donation at thebrewingnetwork.com/donate today.
You're listening to The Brewing Network.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
Oi, oi, oi.
Oi?
Oi, oi.
Oh, okay.
Oi, oi. All right, we're talking carbonation. All right, so we're kind of going over how you know that you have the right amount of carbonation. And then kind of brought up, why is carbonation important? So we kind of touched on this in the definition of carbonation. But one of the things I've spent a lot of time on, and the thing that really interested me in carbonation initially was, if you take a trip over to merry old England, mm-hmm. take a trip over to Britain, things that are carbonated a little lower than we do over here in the U.S.
Right.
And you realize all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's not flat. It actually, kind of marries well with the various styles. So if you have a smaller gravity beer, something with a smaller finishing gravity, and you balance out your carbonation just right, it actually adds to the creaminess of the beer, the mouthfeel of the beer. If you go too right. high on the carbonation on a smaller beer, it becomes harsh and acidic and
water.
And all of a sudden becomes very thin. Mm-hmm. Interesting thing is the good people at Sam Adams who sent me a couple of bottles of chocolate Bock. And a couple of really nice glasses, a letter from Jim Cook. Very nice people, and they, thanks for helping with long shot, and, mm-hmm. One of those bottles leaked. Oh. There's only about half full, but I thought, well, I'll still go ahead and, give it a shot. They chilled it down. I poured it out in a glass. It tastes like water, chocolate Bock water.
Because of the carbonation level.
No carbonation. Real thin and watery. Now, mm-hmm. I imagine if I had added a couple volumes of CO2, it would be rich and full and thick and,
or at least
just a
those
delicious
flavors would have been
dessert
better.
Beer. Yeah. But if I had gone over that, it would again become acidic and harsh and too gassy. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons why carbonation is so darn important. It really changes the character of the beer. I've had in the past beers, and I advocate this, you ferment your beer out, it's done, you put it in a keg, you hook it up to the gas your target carbonation, and you let it sit, and actually a little over your target carbonation, and you check it every day, you take a little taste, and it seems to get better and better and better, and then when you hit the right carbonation level, it'll be a thing of beauty.
Yeah,
just everything comes together—the aromas, the flavors, the mouthfeel. the beer is beautiful. If you continue on with carbonation past that point, what's going to happen is all of a sudden it's going to start to drop off. And it's not going to be quite the beer it was. Body kind of goes south on you, and it's a little harsher, and the flavors are different. Yeah. And, you know, it really changes the beer. The character of the beer changes. There's a magic point for every beer that, it may be different. Now, in Brewing Classic Styles, we list, let's say you're brewing the beers out of Brewing Classic Styles. And it gives kind of a range, usually within a half an atmosphere for various beers. You know, 2 to 2.5 atmospheres for this beer or this style, right?
Right.
And that should be pretty close. Now, depending on your brewing process, how much, long-chain dextrins, a lot of other things that you might have in your beer left behind, that will determine really the ideal carbonation level. So you need to kind of mickey around with it. That's why I kind of like the process of, you know, going with a little higher gas.
Right.
Letting tasting the thing every day. I don't do the shaking thing. You can to kind of force the CO2 in there. But right. letting it kind of build up. And when it gets to that point, you know it. Mm-hmm. You'll know it's just right.
Right.
Or you'll get to a point where you think you've gone past it and it's starting to go downhill. Then you back off on the gas a little bit, you're right in there. Mm-hmm. And it's just perfect.
Yeah.
And I think that's the reason Alan's writing us is because it's a critical part of, you know, what makes a great beer.
Yeah. Another factor comes into play there is temperature. Last week, my wife and I were drinking Baltica 2 Pilsner, which is a Russian Pilsner, and I wasn't serving it really cold. It was kind of warm. It had been in the garage, and when you poured it, the CO2 came out of solution because it was warmer, and when we were drinking that, she was saying, you know, this kind of has a slick feel. It doesn't have very crisp, body to it. And she really didn't care for it. And I said, yeah, it should have been colder. It would have kept some of that carbonation. And then it would have been a brighter beer to drink. Hmm. So, you know, the amount of carbonation and the temperature you serve it at, both of those things, combine to help a beer best express its flavors.
Well, it's not always more carbonation that's needed.
Right.
It's not always less carbonation that's needed. Every beer has its own level of carbonation that is the magical point.
That's right. And it's in Brewing Classic Styles, we talk about the different styles and we talk about what level is appropriate to that style. And a lot of it goes back to, you know, this is the way it was done. These are the mm-hmm. this is the flavor profile that is traditional for a style like a mild, you know, where it's served on cask, mm-hmm. it's served, you know, at a relatively low level of carbonation. And that style and that flavor that you get from the style, you know, all that has evolved around those serving conditions mm-hmm. where these are the flavors that you expect. Well, if you serve that at a higher carbonation, you're not going to get
horrible.
That flavor.
And the funny thing is, if you go over to Britain and you have some of these cask-conditioned beers, properly cask-conditioned beers, and properly, you know, side note, you know, it's great in the U.S. that we're doing, you know, people are serving things on cask, but if it's not a beer that's appropriate to
right.
that level of carbonation, it really doesn't seem that great. It'll be, you know, syrupy or watery or, you know, who knows what.
Yeah.
But, you know, with the right kind of beer and balance and all that, it's a thing of beauty. It's not, you would think, oh, it's not carbonated. No, you don't get that impression at all. You get that it's properly carbonated. There is carbonation. It's gentle. It's right for the style.
Right, right.
And that is, you know, just really highlights the importance of carbonation and beer style and brewing and getting all these numbers right. It's not something that I think there's leeway.
Mm-hmm.
I think you got maybe a half volume leeway, and you can get pretty close, and you can make a decent beer. If you want to make the best beer in the world, you really need to, I think, you know, have a kegging system so you can dial it up and down and make sure that that beer has reached its proper amount of carbonation.
Yeah. Rick Sellers talked about that in the Pacific Brewing News, or his podcast he does, where, you know, they, when they go, you know, drinking pale ales at various brew pubs, you know, often they'll double pour. They'll take get an extra glass and mm-hmm. double pour that beer because often beers are served with too much carbonation.
Well, here in the U.S., yeah, that's one of my pet peeves. They overcarbonate the frickin' daylights out of the beer, and
right.
it, you know, they're filling people up with gas and not beer.
You lose the malt character.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
And so you can't really blame the brewery because the brewery sends out a perfectly carbonated keg, and they send it to whatever pub, and then it sits on gas at a higher pressure,
so
and
they overcarbonate. Yeah.
And well, and a lot of places, some of the bigger breweries, if you're serving their beers, they insist that you serve at a certain pressure and all that, and the people who are used to those mass market beers like a really gassy light,
right?
You know, so it really messes with the other beers. Now we have Chad Mosier in studio with us, and he's got some interesting thoughts about CO2 and some questions about CO2. He's a great brewer, brews great beer, but you know, the question of CO2 is still maybe a little bit of a mystery, huh?
Well, you know, time, how long do you let it sit? If you want to get a keg overpressured, you set it at 15 PSI. How long are you going to get to 3.5 volumes or whatever you need to be at? I mean, is there a magic number? Is there 5 days? Is it a day?
In my experience, it only takes, say, 3 days to come to equilibrium. You can speed that up by rocking the keg, shaking the keg, you know, to help present more surface area, you know, to the gas in the keg. You get that dissolve in factor faster. But, you know, if I overpressure a keg at 15 PSI, a couple 3 days.
Now, see, for me, all right, so you overpressure. Let's say you go with maybe double the pressure that you really need.
Mm-hmm.
It'll reach equilibrium by 3 days.
Okay.
Is what you're saying, right?
Because
I'll go, you know, the pressure that I do need, and it takes maybe a week before it reaches equilibrium. I think
that's true.
Here's Tasty. He's saying, yeah.
And we're talking about forced carbonation here.
Yeah, forced carbonation in a keg.
Yeah. When I first put pressure on a keg, I'll typically crank it up to like 30 PSI. For a couple days, and then back it off.
He's impatient. Yeah,
that's what I've heard. You know, 50 PSI for overnight, and you're good. It's carbonated. I've heard that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But you got to back it off. You got to back.
Yeah,
it
the
off
thing is, you can overshoot things like that. I like the slower method. Mm-hmm. You know, Tasty likes that one too.
Where, needs a rest anyway.
Yeah, you just go with it. You never rush your beer. There's no beer that's ready like, you know, the day after it's fermented. You let something set. Every beer, and I think, I don't know if I wrote this or something.
I doubt it.
Or set it on a show, is every beer needs a period of conditioning, a period of rest. What varies is the length of that based on the beer that you're brewing, the style that you're brewing, or the type of recipe that you're brewing. Certain beers need, you know, years. You know, need three, 4, 5 years. Certain beers need a week. It just depends on the style of beer.
Right.
And so every beer needs a rest of at least a week. Wouldn't you say, Tasty?
Two or three.
And they improve over that time. You know, fines that are in the beer drop out to the bottom and help with head retention, dropping those fines, things like that. So there's a lot of value to letting that beer condition over time. Now, Chad, you're talking about time again. What about you know, bottle conditioning? Let's say you've had your yeast. What about time and temperature on bottle conditioning?
Well, that partly is going to depend on how much yeast you've got still in the bottle. You know, good, strong, healthy fermentation. That has been, you know, fermented over a normal 2 weeks or so, and then bottled. You're going to have enough yeast in there that it'll carbonate within 3, 4, 5 days.
All right.
Then you got to kind of say, okay, let's give it a little bit more time to settle down. I usually plan on 2 weeks for carbonation. Sometimes it takes a month.
I get people that email me and they'll say, hey, you know, my beer isn't carbonated. It's been 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You know, what do I do? And I'm always like, well, give it more time. Warm it up.
Yeah.
You know, put it somewhere warmer and let it sit longer. And right. Eventually it'll go. The only danger to that is if every beer tends to have some bacteria and wild yeast in it.
Right.
It's really difficult to avoid. And if you let that sit at 80 degrees for a month, you're going to start growing some of that stuff unless it's a real high alcohol, real low pH beer.
And depending on the beer, you may get into a trade-off of oxidative or staling damage versus carbonation. So
I had a question as far as, let's say you fermented your beer out, you crash it, say at 40 degrees.
Uh-huh.
Then you want to bottle it, condition it in a bottle. What do you do with the yeast? Do you warm the bottle up? You know, as you pitch the yeast, do you want to warm it up again after crashing? Or do you want to just leave that yeast in suspension anyway?
You can do it
don't
either.
Even crash.
You can do it either way. All right, so a couple of things. If you're going to crash and try and drive all the yeast out of the beer, there's still plenty of yeast in the beer, really. Unless you let it sit for months, it's hard to get rid of all the yeast, unless you filter. If you do filter, or if you do let it sit long enough and there's not enough yeast left in the beer, you're going to want to pitch at a rate of 1 billion cells per liter of beer. So, a gram of dry yeast or a fifth of a pack of White Labs or Y yeast will give you approximately the right yeast load to properly bottle condition the beer. If you're talking about temperature and you're down at temp and you still have enough yeast, really for bottle conditioning and carbonating, you go ahead and let it warm up. Even if it's a lager, what have you, it's okay. Let it warm up to room temperature, 70, 80 degrees. It'll be fine.
Okay. Hey, it's just something I've heard, once your beer is cold, keep it cold. You don't want
to
go back
generally,
up. But if you're bottle conditioning.
Carbonation of beer works better at warmer temperatures. Right. The yeast work faster at warmer temperatures.
It'll do it cold, but it'll take a long time.
Okay, I guess that's
the thing is,
a big question.
You don't want a lot of fluctuation. I think this is the thing you're touching on is, wild fluctuation of beer temperatures over time. Up and down, up and down, up and down, even as little as a half a degree temperature fluctuation over time. This is one of the things they do, kind of getting off track here in the wine world, is, they got to a point where, with technology and all this, they had perfect temperature stability. And, let's say your wine is sitting at 50 degrees day in, day out for years, and for some reason it's not quite aging properly. What they realized is, the shifting of the temperatures, and it was as little as like a half a degree in these caves and stuff, is critical to the conditioning of the wine. So that temperature shift, so they started artificially introducing like a half degree shift back and forth in order to accelerate the conditioning of those things. So the same thing is true about beer. The shift in temperature, I think, will accelerate staling. If you're going up to 80 and down to 40 and up to 80 and down to 40 and up to 80 and down to 40, your beer will age very quickly. If you're talking half degree or a degree, around a stable temperature, it's not as big a deal. So I think if you do it once or twice, not a big deal. If you're doing it on a daily basis or, weekly basis or monthly basis or however long you're storing the beer and it's shifting back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, that's going to stale your beer much faster.
That's interesting. You were talking about that wine process. Is that a today process they use, or is that an old process that
I
tried?
I believe that's what they use today.
Pretty neat.
They realize that, you can't hold it perfectly steady. The wine doesn't properly condition under that.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
What about hoppy beers as far as carbonation? I always hear, from Tasty, crank up the CO2. Let's get those hops popping. If it's a little flat, you kind of I don't know. It just seems a little... Maybe the body, I mean, for one, but as far as flavor profile of the hops, is there anything...
Well, I think there's a lot to say for, you know, carbonation lifting those hop aromatics out to your nose, so you get that. And I think delivering it across the palate, things like that, I think there's a truth to that as well. Again, I think it depends on the beer style. You know, more... the maltier beers probably don't appreciate as much carbonation as the hoppier beers do, and it varies. You know, depending on residual dextrins, you know, alcohols, things like that are going to have a big effect.
Yeah, I mean, if you pour an IPA that's highly carbonated, you know, you get a lot of the hop aromatics coming out of it, and I think. And you probably can, you know, note from your own experience, if you slow pour an IPA, you know, so you don't get much foam in the
it's
pour.
Not lively, yeah.
Yeah. And you don't get the hop coming out, and it's very prickly, and you lose some of the malt character. But if you pour that beer such that you get a good head off of it, now you get a lot more aromatic coming out. The residual carbonation in that glass of beer is softer. You get a lot more of the malt character coming out. If you pour a very cold, highly carbonated, you know, IPA, it's a sharp beer. You don't get the malt character. But if you pour that a little more vigorously, you pour a little warmer, then now you get the balance of the malt and the hops coming out of the beer. So that's, you know, yes, overcarbonate to help push those aromatics. But a lot of, at the same time, that's only part of the story. You need to, you know, think of your serving temperature and how you're pouring that beer in terms to get the best flavor out of it.
That brings up a good point. One of my pet peeves is people easing the beer down the side of the glass and,
yeah,
you know,
no
reserving
foam.
Every,
a college,
you know,
thing. Yeah.
No. You want to pour that beer right down the center of the glass. Let it splash. Let it hit the bottom. You know, build up ahead. Let it kick up. Let it get some foam, get some carbonation. It drives out the aromatics. It's, you know, it
right.
really presents the beer better. I think that's a critical point. What I think we should do now is take a short break.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come back, we're going to get into, you know, questions people have in the chat room.
Sounds like a good idea.
Good.
Smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong.
Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of their 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Their Williams German Pils is mashed with pure German Moravian two-row barley malt for a light blonde color and malty crispness you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out their unique fermenters, draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and more. They even have their own line of precision hydrometers. Go to williamsbrewing.com to browse their vast selection and enter promo code BREW at the order checkout for $5 off your next order over $50. Orders placed by 3 p.m. ship the same day. Again, go to williamsbrewing.com and enter promo code BREW at checkout for $5 off your next order. Brewing is easy the Williams way.
What have you gotten out of a vial of White Labs yeast?
WLP-001, Cal Ale, baby!
23, Burton Ale.
008, East Coast Ale.
Cal Common, WLP-810.
It's gonna be WLP-400 with beer!
I got a sweet hoodie for my vial.
Huh?
White Labs, your source for great brewer's yeast, would like to invite all homebrewers to join the White Labs Customer Club. Redeem your empty vials for great White Labs merchandise and products. Free yeast, glassware, t-shirts, baseball caps, sweatshirts, polo shirts, and you won't believe what you'll get for 5,000 vials. Members also receive a newsletter packed with White Labs updates and facts, interviews with professional brewers, brew your own clone recipes, beercook.com recipes, and customer club stories. The White Labs Customer Club. Save your vials and get in the club. White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Live. Beer Radio. The Brewing Network.
The Brewcasters.
If you're just starting, don't be discouraged by all this stuff. It's so easy.
Just throw it together.
Put some sugar and some water and some yeast in there.
Yeah.
Brewing Network.
Like the Lance Armstrong of the beer world. Except for that nut thing.
This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. You know, we're so passionate about this carbonation issue. That, you know, we're just all, you know, raging here in the studio in between. And I think...
You brought up a really good anecdote. I mean, it illustrates it well.
All right, so a couple of things. We started off with saying, all right, if you had a perfect beer, right, just flawless, this is, you know, BJCP scale, 50-point beer. It's absolutely perfect beer. If you change the carbonation just a little bit, it's no longer a perfect beer. It's gonna reduce. As an example, the back of my point, we went with the family down to Disneyland for a few days down in Anaheim, California, and there's this place called JT Schmidt's. We went there on Sunday when we got down there, and I had 22-ounce glass of their amber ale, which I enjoyed before, and it was perfect, absolutely freaking the best amber beer I've ever had in my life. Everything was flawless, from the recipe to the brewing to the presentation, everything. You know, just an ideal balance between the roasty, the hoppy, the caramel, the, you know, every aspect of the beer. And I had two of those bad boys easily, just fan-frickin-tastic, you know, and carbonation plays, you know, it had a kind of a creamy feel, but enough to kick out the aromas, things like that.
Yeah.
Exactly a week later, we're back, same brewery, it's the same batch, they haven't brewed another batch, it's still in the, you know, the serving tank, but the serving tank has been drawn down over that course of that week. When you draw down the tank, the volume, you know, the CO2, things like that, you know, the serving conditions change and the carbonation change just slightly.
Gets a little bit higher.
Yeah. And it was no longer a 50-point beer, maybe a 48-point beer. Still a great beer, but not nearly as perfect. As I consumed the glass, as the glass had a chance to stand a little bit, some of the carbonation could come out a little bit, like Chad was pointing out, it actually improved.
Yeah.
It was actually back to that great beer. So you find differences in CO2 do make a big difference in, you know, in your beer. I wouldn't freak out about it, but be aware
that
you have a beer that doesn't seem quite right, you might mess around with the CO2, especially if you have a kegging system, and you will realize that there's a big difference there.
Right. Yeah.
And when it comes to competition time, I mean, it's not just, hey, it's low carbonation. It's affecting flavor profile, body, everything across the board.
Yep.
So, I mean, how do they judge that? If the carbonation, they pour it in a glass, how is that looked at?
Well, I think you asked this before on the on another show, you know, when I judge, I have, you know, I imagine what it would be with more or less carbonation. Hmm. And that'll carry you so far, but generally, most judges they judge it as is.
Right.
And they're not going to help you with carbonation, or they may say it's too low or too high, but they're not going to imagine what it could be based on different carbonation. So I think you're kind of screwed.
Yeah, you know, you think about the judging process where you pour the beer, and the first thing you look at is appearance, you know. and you'll say, yeah, a lot of carbonation, it has a good head. You look for head first. And if it's got a low carbonation, it's not going to have a good head. Maybe you take your first sip and you say, okay, I taste these characters. If the carbonation is high, it's going to taste a little sharper. You're not going to get the malt character. But they keep tasting that beer, you know, as they're scoring the beer. And, you know, 3, 5, or 5 minutes is going to go by as they continue to taste the beer. They'll probably swirl it again to try to pick up some more aromas, you know, secondary characteristics. That carbonation level is going to go down because, you know, you're talking about, you know, 2 or 3 ounces of beer in a wide, you know, plastic cup. And as that carbonation goes down during the tasting session, you know, more malt character is going to come out of that beer. And I think one thing that in the competition show that you did on the session, I believe, where you talked about how to build beers for competition, you know, and what competition is all about, over carbonating a little bit to help bring out different characters at different stages of the scoring of the beer helps. You're going to want a little bit more carbonation to start with, because as the judge, you know, judges that beer and swirls it and smells it and tastes it, if that beer starts out low carb, it's going to be really flat by the time it's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so from a competition point of view, you may want a little more carbonation to start with.
I think we need another competition show where I give out really bad advice.
Okay,
and that's it. That'll help me. time I can like screw everybody up.
Yeah, but I mean, the carbonation. I guess what we're talking about in this context is that carbonation brings out, you know, beer
mm-hmm.
character.
Mm-hmm.
High carbonation helps bring out the aromatics.
Well,
low carbonation helps accentuate some of the malt.
The very first thing you and I both know, BJCP judges, and we judge a lot of competitions. The very first thing you do is check aromatics.
Yep.
So a little bit extra CO2, you know,
helps
pop those aromatics, and then then you're onto appearance and flavor and things like that, and so. We're not talking a huge amount of CO2, but just a tiny hair more will really, really help with that. All right, Justin, you got questions from the chat room?
Yes, we do. A few good questions came through. Here's one. It's also kind of a discussion on the Brewing Network forum right now. Someone wanted to know if you could, carbonate a beer with nitrogen, although the question asker knows that you're not carbonating it. But could you all the way through... quote, carbonate a beer with just nitrogen.
Right. So the reason you for everybody to listen, the reason you can't carbonate a beer with nitrogen is there's no carbon dioxide, right? So carbonation requires carbon dioxide. If you're using nitrogen, then there's no carbon dioxide, and obviously you're not carbonating the beer.
Yeah.
The reason that nitrogen carbon dioxide blends or beer gas is used is to create a lower carbon dioxide level in the beers. It's creamier because you're using less carbon dioxide, but there's bubbles to stir it up. The thing about using 100% nitrogen is you could use 100% nitrogen, but nitrogen really doesn't dissolve well in liquids, and it tends to come out. And you would end up with a very watery tasting beer.
Right.
So you really can't do 100% nitrogen gasification of
yeah.
Beer.
I find that
it's not going to work.
Yeah, beer gas mixtures. And when you get a stout at a pub or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, you let that go flat over. You know, if say you nurse it over a half hour.
Half hour. What's the matter with you?
I've talked to interesting people. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, as that beer gets flat, mm-hmm. it gets very watery because
right.
there's a lot less residual carbonation right. in that beer
yeah.
because it's been partially nitrogenated. Mm-hmm. The equilibrium concentration is a lot less.
Right. So you really, I mean, you can do it, but the result is going to be unpleasant.
Okay. Here's another good question. Does attenuation have much to do with how fast a beer will absorb CO2? The example is Brancid, one of our listeners, says, I've noticed that beers that I try to finish at a gravity over 10-15, like a barley wine, tend to need more pressure to get to a nice carbonation. Is that is there a relation there?
Well,
there is a relationship between residual or
right,
gravity
it's
carbon
chain
solubility.
Long chain sugars and all that. It's the dextrins that you know are going to affect mouthfeel and all that. So you know the level of CO2 will change, but
perception
know, the,
of the balance is going to change too. And that's probably the overriding factor.
The partial pressure gases are not really affected by dissolved sugars in the solution.
Right. But the perception of those.
Yeah, perception will change. But I think his question is like, you know, how.
Amount of time.
How you know, how is it going to. Let's say you have, the transfer of partial pressure of gas to a solution is really not affected by gravity.
Right. And I guess what I'm saying is that.
You need more to overcome that. Sure.
In a barley wine, to get the same kind of mouthfeel that you get in a Pilsner, mm-hmm. you're going to have to crank that up to like 3 atmospheres
right,
versus
right.
2 atmospheres.
Well,
because the higher sweetness of a barley wine.
But his question is time.
Right.
Does it really take longer?
Well, but it works that way too then,
right.
because it would take longer only in the sense that you're having to put more CO2 into it. But it doesn't take longer to get the same amount of CO2 into a lesser beer.
Right.
It's just that you need more CO2.
You're talking higher gas pressure, so the time should be the same.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Yeah. I guess you're right, Jay-Z, as far as you know what the question was asking and what I'm answering is kind of different. But if you have a barley wine versus a Pilsner, you know, the big difference in gravity, mm-hmm. final gravity of the two beers, and if you're expecting a barley wine to have the same mouthfeel as the Pilsner, you're going to have to put a lot more CO2 mm-hmm. into that mm-hmm. to counter the residual sweetness and the heavier gravity of that barley wine
right.
to get the same mouthfeel. It's going to, and that will take longer to happen unless you have a higher overpressure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you don't have enough pressure, it's never going to happen.
Right.
There comes a state of equilibrium.
So if the person is asking why does it take longer to carbonate a higher gravity beer, if he's looking for the same mouthfeel in each beer, regardless of style, then yeah, a higher gravity brew like a barley wine or a Bock is going to take longer or need a higher level of CO2 to get the same kind of mouthfeel that he's looking for.
Let's make sure we're not confusing anybody here. If you use a lower pressure, let's say you use 6 psi or 5 psi at 38 degrees or 40 degrees Fahrenheit,
right.
You're going to reach a point where there's a certain amount of carbonation. It's not going to get at that pressure and temperature. You could leave it on there for a decade, and
right.
it's never going to get more than a certain amount of CO2.
Right.
It's probably reached that point by about a week to 10 days. It has reached that equilibrium. You leave it sitting there for 10 years, it's still at the same amount of CO2.
Right.
Right? So don't get confused that the longer you leave it, you're going to get more CO2. The reason people think that, I think, a lot of times is they're using 20, 25 PSI, which is way more than they really need. And, you know, it gets more and more and more CO2 over time, and then they finish the keg and they're done. You know, dial in the appropriate pressure. You get yourself Brewing Classic Styles from the Brewing Network store, signed by both John Palmer and Jamil Sandershaft. And then, use that chart in there to dial in the correct pressure for the temperature of the beer is at, and then you will get the appropriate level of CO2. And
right.
And at that point, you can leave it hooked up forever.
Right,
and it's not gonna. You're gonna be fine. So mm-hmm. That's one of the things.
All right, some other questions came through. How do you bottle condition a Flanders Red? I thought this was interesting because I wouldn't have expected there's a difference in bottle conditioning any beer.
Right, you know the only real difference in something like a Flanders Red you're dealing with is the pH of the beer.
Okay.
If it's low enough, it can inhibit the activity of the yeast you're going to use to carbonate with. So, you know, that's one thing to worry about. But generally, you can just go ahead and carbonate and bottle condition just like any other beer.
Okay. All right. Here's a good question. Someone asked, if you overcarbonate and then you pour out the beer, you let it sit for a little while to get back to a normal carbonation, do you end up with the same beer as if you had carbonated it properly the first time? Or
no.
Have you changed the beer just by overcarbonating it?
You changed it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, and part of that, that was pouring it out. Okay. Every time, you know, you form head, those head-forming proteins and all that, they're gone. They're spent. They're not there again. So that does actually change the beer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah, it is.
Will the use of a carbonation stone help speed the process up?
Generally, no. You're faster off of just shaking.
Okay.
It's the same thing with trying to put oxygen into wort. You can use those stones. They really don't provide a whole lot of transfer of gas across the interface there. So you're actually better off just shaking it. Yeah, you know, carbonation stones will work better than doing nothing, but actually shaking it does wonders.
So I've heard with pro brewers, I mean, that's how they're getting carbonated so quick, with those diffusion stones in line.
Yeah, you know.
Well, in
but
line.
They're in line, which is different.
Okay,
right?
Serving, you mean.
Well, and it's, you know, continuous.
I mean,
they're pumping across and they're doing a continuous thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you run that for a long time, it will. And you can't really shake those larger serving tanks. So, but in a little keg, if you shake it, it goes really fast.
Yeah.
That's probably the fastest. It's the same thing, you know, trying to get oxygen into liquid. You know, here's an interesting thing. Let me digress. I used to do a lot of aquarium stuff before. And one of the reasons that you have like those little air stones in the bottom of aquarium, bubbling up, you're thinking, oh, it's adding oxygen to the tank. No, it's not. It's actually exchanging. It's getting the liquid to turn over across the surface of the tank. And it's a surface that actually picks up the oxygen. You can make the same effect. You get a pump that just pumps the water around, circulates the water in the tank, and you gain more oxygen from that than you will from these air stones. So the bubbles really don't have that much surface area as compared to. It seems like a lot, but you know, the whole trick is just exchanging that surface area against the gas. So, you know, same thing in kegs.
Okay, a couple more good questions. What factors affect bubble size?
Well, that would be your beer composition, for one. Beta-glucans, proteins, final gravity.
Nucleation sites.
Yeah, nucleation. Uh-huh. And then your beer gas mix. I mean, if you've got, everybody knows that if you use a nitrogen carbon dioxide mix, you get finer bubbles and a creamier mouthfeel from a beer gas mix than you do from straight carbon dioxide. But there's a lot of factors that go into that.
I've always kind of wondered about that too, because I found that Sierra Nevada, for example,
mm-hmm.
has large gas bubbles compared to other pale ales that I've had. I don't know what it, or if it's just more carbonated and I'm perceiving it that way, but I always perceived it as kind of these larger gas bubbles than normal. And again, I don't know if that's just that it has more carbonation or if something has affected the size of the bubbles in that beer.
It's going to be chemistry of the liquid. I mean, the size of the bubble is going to be driven by the surface tension, the bubble.
How big a bubble it can form before it breaks loose.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So, all the, you know, the chemistry of the beer is going to help drive that final bubble size. You know, if it's a straight CO2, if it's a, you know, a mix of gases, that's also going to drive that final bubble size.
So what I find also is, and I learned this off like my very first Scottish 60 shilling, is, you know, a low finishing gravity beer, if you don't let that sit, there's a lot of fines in brewing that come from the grains, you know, highly kiln grains. They become real powdery and have just microscopic pieces of grain bits and things like that. And they float around in the beer. If you let that sit for long enough, they'll eventually settle out. And once they do, they're no longer there as nucleation sites for the CO2. And you get a much better head, you get a much better presentation if you let all that stuff drop out. So like Tasty is saying, you'll let your beer condition over time, and it actually will improve some of those things.
Okay. All right, and one last good question from the chat. Once you've reached your equilibrium in the keg, is it all right then just to disconnect it and store it cold that way, or do you need to keep it pressured with the CO2 all the time?
Once you've reached it, and if you need to store it, you just go ahead and disconnect it and store it.
Okay.
It's not going to change. As long as you don't have a leak, it's not going to change.
As long as it's sealed, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
All right, good questions from the chat, and that's going to do it.
Great. So let's wrap this up. I think CO2 is very important. We determined that. I think the charts in Brewing Classic Styles will help you determine how much priming sugar or keg pressure you'd need.
Right, to dial in a certain level of volumes.
Right. What else? If you're naturally carbonating and it's not working out quite right, give it time.
Right.
Just wait. Don't open it up and add more yeast and do all that screwy stuff. Just give it time at temperature, and I think you get close.
Right.
What else did we determine?
The carbonation level helps drive the flavors of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, too much, too little.
Determine's important. Yeah, yeah.
If you're attempting to carbonate for competition, you may want a little bit more to help help carry the beer through the judging process.
Mm-hmm.
Chad, any take homes occur to you?
No.
Okay.
that was helpful. Thank you very much.
Of course. Yes.
If you're force carbonating with the keg, CO2 is CO2 is CO2.
Right.
It really doesn't matter where it comes from, it's CO2. Now, there may be other flavor compounds that are introduced by, bottle conditioning, et cetera.
Right.
But probably the most important thing is getting rid of the excessive yeast that might come from bottle conditioning is probably one of the tricky things.
Yeah, and that's one reason. I mean, don't bottle too soon. Let that beer sit in the fermenter where you get some yeast drop. Let that beer condition in the fermenter for a period of time.
There's still a ton of yeast in there.
Yes.
Even though it looks brilliantly clear, lots of yeast still left in suspension.
And that will carbonate. And as Jamil says, if you have too much yeast in the bottle, you're going to run into a risk of autolysis versus, conditioning and carbonating, that trade-off between getting good carbonation.
If you do filter, you need about 1 billion cells per liter of yeast to bottle condition. That's the same number that Sierra Nevada uses.
See, Chad, we were talking about a lot of good stuff here, and you just blew it off.
Good stuff.
He's busy bringing us some of his fine beer.
That's true.
So he gets a pass on that. All right. So another good show, I think.
I hope so, yeah. I enjoyed it, certainly.
Well, we'll see how many people pay for the show, and that'll tell us. Nobody will pay for the show. That's because it's free. Yeah. All right, so we don't know what our next show is going to be, but keep those suggestions coming. Brew strong at thebrewingnetwork.com. While you're at there at thebrewingnetwork.com, stop by the store. Maybe pick up a subscription to BYO Magazine. Both John Palmer and myself.
It's a good magazine.
Monthly columns in that magazine, and you're going to find a lot of good stuff in there. And a portion of the sale goes to continuing programming like this on the Brewing Network.
That's right.
Pick yourself up a Brew Strong t-shirt.
Very nice t-shirts.
Those are very nice. I got mine here. I'm very excited. Maybe some signed copies of Brewing Classic Styles and How to Brew.
Yeah. And check out the store, everybody. And look forward to hearing from you next week. Next show, I mean.
All right, everybody. Brew strong.
Brew strong.